Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. In April, Wisconsin voters, by large margins, approved a controversial and significant constitutional amendment that alters state law by providing stronger protections for alleged crime victims. Marcy's Law is named for Marcy Nichols, who was stalked and murdered by her ex-boyfriend in 1983. Supporters say the law provides crucial new rights for victims and ensures their voices are heard. Critics, though, say Wisconsin's version of Marcy's Law undermines our court system's framework, in effect eliminating certain constitutional rights of the accused. And most experts say the logistics of implementing the new rules in courtrooms statewide won't be easy. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Today, we discuss the implications of Marcy's Law and the way prosecutors, judges, and defense attorneys are responding to the changes that are now required to ensure they comply with the new rules. Joining us today is Marathon County District Attorney Teresa Whetstone. Teresa, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Marathon County Circuit Judge Mike Moran. Judge, welcome back to Route 51 today.
Good to be here.
You can join the conversation, too, by calling us at 800-780-9742 or emailing us at route51@wpr.org. Callers, please allow plenty of time for our producer to answer your call. So I'd like to start with an overview of Marcy's Law, what it does, how it differs from previous victims' rights under the state constitution. Teresa, what exactly, in a nutshell, does the law do?
Well, just a little bit of background, I guess. It's part of a nationwide effort to elevate crime victims' rights to a constitutional level that's equal to the accused in every state. So that's kind of the backdrop of the nationwide effort. And the constitutional amendment is designed to provide model language that can be used as a starting point in the states. So Marcy's Law, in Wisconsin, we had Chapter 950 of the statutes, which did afford victim and witness rights already legislatively in Wisconsin. The constitutional amendment in some way reinforces those established rights under the statutes and in some ways enhances the rights provided under the statute.
So there is some backstory behind Marcy's Law. I know this this has been a push for some time. Can you explain a little bit about where it started and how this push began, Judge?
Teresa would probably have a better idea of the background on how it came to be pushed. We've had a really strong, I think, victims' rights statutes and everything like that, protections in Wisconsin. And I'm not really sure what the background is how it came about in Wisconsin. Maybe Teresa would have more information on that.
Sure. Teresa, do you know what's the backstory on this?
Well, like I said, I think the nationwide effort was a recognition that although there are victims' rights in place, the vigor by which they're honored and made sure that they're respected in courts of law and criminal process was questionable, and I'm not saying that in Wisconsin or locally. I think just as a national level, people were recognizing that. And in, I think 2008 was the first passage of Marcy's Law in California, I believe. And so a number of states have passed such an amendment, California, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Nevada. So Wisconsin's not alone, and there are several other states as well. So Judge Moran is right that Wisconsin really was a leader in victims' rights already, but certainly the constitutional amendment has elevated that in Wisconsin and caused us in the criminal justice system really to think of the victims at every point in the system and be very conscious about that, and I do think that's a positive.
So, I would agree. I know in Marathon County, and that's what I can speak from, we've had a victim witness coordinator for as long as I can remember. I've been around a long time, and we've had really strong victim witness people in the Marathon County District Attorney's Office. So I really have felt that Wisconsin has been very strong, and Marathon County certainly has been very strong regarding victims' rights. This just codifies a lot of the things that I think we were doing, plus adds a lot more requirements that are positive for victims' victims having a say or to be able to opt in to court appearances, to make sure there are court hearings, to make sure that their voices are heard. So it really takes a lot of what we were doing before, adds things. But Wisconsin's had a very strong victim advocacy history, I believe.
Sure. In 1980, I know Wisconsin was the first state in the country to adopt a crime victims' bill of rights. So they really, the state really has been a leader in this issue. The law now states that victims have a right to due process in criminal prosecutions. And we hear a lot about due process with respect to the accused, but maybe not so much about victims. Judge, can you explain what due process is? I mean, we hear it a lot. But what is it really?
Well, you know, there have been a lot of Supreme Court cases and a lot of courts that have struggled with what exactly is due process. Due process is to be able to have your rights in court. I mean, that somebody doesn't, deny you your constitutional rights, deny you the rights that you have under the statutes, under the case law. And it really is, to ensure that fairness in court. That's how I view it. We have a Constitution that has a Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights talks about all the different rights that defendants have. What this law has done is essentially afforded or given, extended, I guess would be the better word, some of those rights to victims of crimes, so that it's not something that you can, it's not statutory. It's a constitutional right, which means it has the effect and the backing of a constitutional amendment. So it's not just, it's a violation of the statute. It's a violation of the Constitution if those rights are not followed. So it gives it that kind of a backing, that kind of importance. But we try to maintain due process rights for defendants. We've done that, and over time we've had a history of all those. This is fairly new, and I think we're about a month into the law, and we really haven't had any trials given the COVID situation. So we really haven't seen how a lot of the new law has affected, like, for example, trials, for example, trial preparation. We're still kind of looking at how this is going to affect. It has had effects on a number of different areas. I'm sure we're going to go into that. But we're still looking at how this is going to affect us.
So, Teresa, how does this right to due process change the process from a prosecutor's standpoint?
Well, I think the right to due process really emphasizes the right to be meaningfully heard.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what happens is, Judge Moran said, you know, we have a victim witness coordinator in the district attorney's office, and the prosecutor has throughout the years been available to victims to speak with, for the victim to confer with about any negotiations and things of that nature. But to be meaningfully heard in the court of law, with the court being the listener, is really heightened by this constitutional amendment. And so that has changed. So we now are very cognizant in every hearing that we do. First of all, we're transitioning to almost virtually all hearings with victim crimes, whether or not they've opted in under their rights under the current statutory scheme. We now have the court proceedings on the record. So there's an opportunity for a victim at any point in time to opt in and participate in the hearing and be meaningfully heard on issues that implicate their rights. And so that is a pretty big change, because we did have hearings that were taking place, and that was fine under the prior scheme, but were taking place off the record, or scheduling was taking place off the record. That didn't afford the victim that opportunity that they now have under some of the new procedures that we have.
So this, the right to be heard, I guess that brings up some questions for, on how this is going to be handled. We know that victims of domestic violence, for example, often want charges against a defendant to be reduced or dismissed. So the way that Marcy's law is written, then, both judge and prosecutor would be obliged to hear the victim express that view potentially in every court appearance. So what do you see the impact that has on the ability to prosecute in these kinds of cases, Teresa?
Well, I think that they have the right to be heard. I think the right is, so many hearings that we have are dealing with scheduling, the next stage in the process, And the right to be heard at that hearing would deal with the scheduling of the next event. Is there a concern about the length of time it's taking to get scheduled? Is there a concern about the date that's actually scheduled? That's not something that the victim could attend the next hearing. They have a conflict, things like that. Then there will be hearings where I think the things that you just discussed may be addressed. And I think at when bail is being set, that is a time where a victim can express concerns. I think that at sentencing, that would be another time that there could be concerns raised. At a plea hearing where someone is changing their plea to guilty or no contest, that could be another opportunity for that. Now, I think for the most part, those options were there for victims in the past. I think that except for, with the exception of plea hearings, I think that was not as strong. But I do think now there is a conscious effort by all involved in the court process to ensure that we inquire whether there is a victim present to address the court. So, you know, there still needs to be, there are still some parameters, depending on the type of hearing and what's appropriate to address at that hearing. But yes, there will be opportunities for victims to be heard, as there should be throughout the process.
So even in cases of domestic violence where we know, I mean, unfortunately, it happens all the time where I shouldn't say all the time, but it happens so frequently where victims want those charges to be reduced. They want them to be dismissed. I mean, Judge, you used to be a public defender before you became a judge.
Yes.
So, I mean, how do you see that factoring in the defense strategy, especially in these kinds of cases?
I'm not sure it would really be a strategy of any sort. I mean, you know, as a judge coming from the perspective of listening, I ask in any sentencing or I ask in any scheduling or any type of proceeding right now, is there anyone that wishes, any victim that wishes to speak or to give input at this time? We haven't had, I think the law is still pretty new to really to see how many people are actually going to proceed and follow this constitutional right that victims have, but in that situation, it's not really a strategy. It is what it is. I guess is the best way to say it. If I were a defense attorney and this law would come out, you know, it would be something that that's always been there. It's always been a situation. I think everybody has to listen to victims. It gives them a voice. It gives them the input, and you know, they have that. That's what, when you talk about due process, what is due process? Due process, and I didn't give a great answer for it, but it's that nobody is prejudiced and everyone has equal treatment. And it just adds another voice that may or may not have been part of the discussion before. You know, to have input doesn't mean necessarily that the parties have to, you know, have to actually, I hate to say it, but follow what's being said. But it's the fact that there's input and there's a voice there, and it's another perspective, another very important perspective, a constitutional perspective at this point, as to what the victim would like to see happen. I don't really view it as any kind of a strategy. Before, if a victim wanted to recant, or if there was, you know, their thoughts were that they didn't want the person, for example, to go to prison, they would write letters to the district attorney's office. It would go through the same process with the victim witness coordinator. And it wouldn't change a whole lot. This just formalizes a lot of what was done before, in my opinion.
You're listening to Marathon County District Attorney Teresa Whetstone and Circuit Judge Mike Moran, our guests today on Route 51, as we discuss Marcy's Law, an amendment to the state constitution that has had a significant impact on courtrooms in our region. When we return, we'll discuss some specific language in the law and how those new requirements are being met. You can join the conversation, too, by calling 800-780-9742 or emailing questions and comments to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Marathon County Circuit Judge Mike Moran and Marathon County District Attorney Teresa Whetstone are our guests today as we discuss the implications of Marcy's Law, a new constitutional amendment approved in April by Wisconsin voters in courtrooms across the region. We'll take your questions, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. When calling, please allow enough time for our producer to answer your call or email us at route51@wpr.org. Marcy's Law gives victims the right to privacy. Privacy, of course, it's always been important for victims. We know they can be re-victimized when their names are made public. Critics, though, are saying that this could be problematic because victims will have to testify in court and respond to questions that might intrude upon their privacy. So my question, Teresa, how do you protect victim privacy in light of the new law? What's changed?
It's an interesting question because there are requirements under the law, and we need to be conscious of the defendant's constitutional rights, federal constitutional rights at all time, as well as our ethical obligations as attorneys. That said, we for years at the Marathon County District Attorney's Office have really taken proactive steps to protect the privacy of victims. We have been redacting unnecessary information. When I say unnecessary, I mean it's not really relevant to the case. It's information that may have been gathered during the course of the investigation, but it doesn't pertain to the crime. It's not necessary for any of the analysis of whether or not a crime has been committed. We've been redacting that proactively for a long time. So there are different stages that we need to look at the privacy. In a criminal complaint that's filed as a matter of public record, we can use pseudonyms for the victim. We do not have to identify by name. We've been doing that recently. We've been using abbreviations for victims' names, redacting personal addresses within the criminal complaints, other sensitive information that's not relevant to the crime, things like that. Now we are definitely looking more at discovery that we provide to defense. And what we have to be very careful of, we have to make it very obvious what we're redacting. If the defense were to challenge it, they have the right to do that and say, I really want that information. I think it's important, and the judge can make a determination if that should be revealed. So we make it very obvious in our discovery practice what's being redacted so that the defense can object if they feel it's appropriate. But dealing of information that's now being filed throughout the court process, let's say it's motions defense has filed or other things, we can seal it from the public if there is sensitive information in there about juvenile victims, victims in general. This applies to victims whether it's a sensitive crime or not, or a juvenile victim or not. This is all victims. So we are very conscious of that already, but that certainly will be heightened now.
I think that we're going to have to at some point revisit because it is a fairly new law, and we really haven't had, you know, because of what's been going on, our courts have really not been at full capacity for several months now. So we really haven't had those contested type hearings where a lot of the issues that, like what you've talked about, privacy and those other issues, would be in the forefront when it comes to contested trials and contested motion hearings. We're just starting to get back into doing those regular court type hearings, and I think we're gonna learn more about how Marcy's Law is going to affect the adversarial system that we have. We have an adversarial system where we have due process rights now, you know, for both sides, for both victims and for defendants. And that balancing is going to be important as to how we do that. But we now have more direction, and that's important. There's always been that conflict, that balance. Like I said, I can't say enough that our district attorney's office here in Marathon County have been very on the forefront of a lot of these issues, even before Marcy's Law. And is there going to be dramatic changes? I don't think here in Marathon County. There may be in other counties where there hasn't been that emphasis on victims' rights before. But in Marathon County, I think that we're not going to see as dramatic of a difference from what was done, you know, up until Marcy's Law was passed, at least from my perspective as a public defender before and as a judge now. So, I mean, that says something about Marathon County. It really does, that they've been ahead of the game. And Marcy's Law just really puts it together, codifies it, makes it a part of our Constitution. And I think that that's why we're not going to see that dramatic change.
Go ahead, Teresa.
I was just going to say one of the things that's difficult as a prosecutor is, and the district attorney, is that sometimes these rights almost come in conflict. So the right to privacy doesn't just encompass written reports. It also encompasses body cameras, interviews, recordings,
yes,
like that, which are overwhelming, the volume of materials that a prosecutor receives. So we do our best with the written word, the reports, but we also are cognizant of the fact that we don't want unreasonable delay in a case for a victim as well. But in order to really give Marcy's Law the effect it should have, we should be redacting the audiovisual recordings as well, but the amount of time that would take and the delay that would cause in the court process, they come in conflict because, you know, when things like this pass, people don't think about the or they don't at least a lot for the resources to actually enact this to be done the way it was intended. So if we're going to have these extra things that we really want to do, we've always really wanted to do, we have to have the resources and the manpower and the, you know, finances to back that up in order to implement them. And so it's a concern when you put these in place without those things also in place.
We've had to look at our scheduling. How do we schedule court appearances? Because we have to assume that a victim can input at any time. They don't have to announce it to the district attorney's office that they're going to be there. They can show up at any time there's a hearing. First of all, a lot of cases in Marathon County don't have victims. I mean, there's a lot of different types of cases that don't have the notification or Marcy's Law would not necessarily apply to. But we assume as judges and as a group we've decided, and we've met many times on this, that we're going to have any cases that involve victims, that we're going to assume that victim could show up at any time to want to give input. So we've had to change our scheduling, how we do hearings, and put more on the record. All scheduling done with victim cases is now on the record. It used to be where people would come back and they would schedule it with our judicial assistant. We do that all on the record now. We do all our final pretrials on the record. We do all these different other hearings on the record so that there's an opportunity. We just make that assumption that a victim is going to want to have input. And that has added to our scheduling, and that has added to the time that we're in court. You know, and if that's the case, then other cases that, you know, we have to adjust. So we're still in that adjustment period, trying to figure out the best way to follow Marcy's Law and to the full extent, and also to, you know, keep the court system running and keep going. And we're trying to find that balance.
I do want to get back to the delays in a moment, but first we have a caller. Kate from Wapaka is on the line. Kate has a question about due process. Thanks for calling, Kate.
Thank you. So my question has to do with the due process rights that defendants are afforded by the Constitution. With the creation of Marcy's Law, now victims have some due process rights. What is the plan for when a victim's due process right conflicts with a defendant's due process right? For example, a victim might have a due process right to privacy, but a defendant might have a due process right to learn about what the allegation is that's being made by the victim in order to prepare a defense.
Teresa,
okay, so what about those conflicts, Judge? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, there are federal constitutional rights, you know, under the Fifth Amendment, those types of things. That we have to follow those. I hate to make a broad brush with this, but everything is sort of a case by case basis. Obviously, federal, there's a long history of on our Constitution upholding defendants' rights, and these are federal rights. Marcy's Law is a states' rights thing. I'm not sure exactly how that's going to play out. We haven't really had it in play yet. We haven't really had these situations yet. But we have to be mindful. Due process does require us to give defendants those due process rights that they have historically and have constitutionally been afforded. And we have a long history of case law that talks about that. I think that there's a way that both constitutional rights can be upheld, but I'm at a loss as to what that situation is exactly when it comes up. I'm sure there'll be lots of litigation on it, but we do have to. We defendants have a long history of constitutional rights. We all know the rights that are out there. This is all very new. I guess I can't stress it. It's all very new, and we're as courts are still in the process of discussing. In fact, we have a meeting on Marcy's Law on Monday to really discuss these issues as they come up. But we're going to follow the Constitution. We're going to follow the federal Constitution. We're going to follow the state Constitution, and that's how we're going to proceed. I can't give you a much better answer than that.
Well, and I agree. I think that is a concern. I do think that, there's a great resource online that is from the Office of Crime Victim Services, and it says even at the end of that, specifically, it's not intended or to be interpreted to supersede a defendant's federal constitutional rights.
Exactly. And exactly. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. So I believe that, you know, what is going to occur, there are a number of rights for victims that have been developed through case law in Wisconsin. And I think that there was some ambiguity or vagueness to that that has sort of allowed victims' rights to be sort of overlooked, or it's been stretched a lot to impede on victims' rights. But so I think this is going to bring it back more to victims having a right and a say in whether or not their confidential records, for example, are released. However, I think the courts are going to be very cognizant of a defendant's federal constitutional rights at all times. And there will be litigation, I am sure, on these issues. And I look forward to that for some clarification. And I think everybody anticipated that with Marcy's Law, that there would need to be litigation. There's also conflicts between Chapter 950, our statutory language, and the constitutional amendments that need to be dealt with by the legislature. And obviously that can't happen right now. So we're awaiting that as well. So right now what our courts in Marathon County are trying to do is be proactive and do the best we can with what we know right now.
And thank you. You shared the review of proposed changes, the link with us. We will put that up on our website as well, wpr.org/Route 51. And we've been talking about conflicts between victims' rights and the rights of the accused. Here's another thing. You know, the law gives victims the right to refuse an interview, a deposition, or other discovery request. Under the federal constitution, specifically the 6th and 14th Amendments, the accused in a state criminal case has a right to disclosure of exculpatory information at a minimum. So, Teresa, how do you balance that?
Well, there always has been, under Chapter 950, the current statutory scheme, a right for a victim to refuse to be deposed or refuse to have an interview, let's say, with a defense investigator. So that actually isn't that change. So when you're talking about exculpatory information, that's a different. You have to be careful not to lump those two concepts together, I guess. So we are, under all circumstances, any possession of the state of exculpatory evidence, nothing has changed and nothing will change that we have an obligation to turn that over. So subjecting, like you talked about domestic violence victims, for example, subjecting a victim to a deposition or requiring them to be deposed or anything of that nature, That hasn't been allowed, and I don't know if the judge wants to weigh in on that as well, but under Chapter 950, and that's been in place for quite some time, and we have not. Judge, I don't know if you've seen any issues with that, but...
I really haven't. I haven't seen that as far as requests for depositions and that type of thing for victims. I have not seen that. No, I think you're absolutely right about, you know, there is exculpatory evidence is covered under the U.S. Constitution. There's case law that talks about, and I don't think this necessarily changes anything of that nature. I think what's going to happen is I think you're going to find that these issues are going to be brought up when we start doing motion hearings, preparing for trial, and that the judges are going to have to make those decisions on a case-by-case basis. I can't really say that this is what's going to happen in all cases. But we have a new constitutional provision here to consider when we make those decisions on evidence of the type that we're talking about involving victims. We just have a new layer of how we have to look at these cases, and over time it's going to develop, and the courts are going to be involved in it pretty extensively. But we just don't have the time yet to really know, and the situations yet to really be able to evaluate exactly how the courts are going to rule on these issues.
So again, that review of proposed changes is now up on our website for those who want to review it. It's wpr.org/route51. Teresa, what were you going to add?
I was just going to say under the existing law, under Chapter 950, it says the victim had a right not to be compelled to submit to a pretrial interview or deposition by a defendant or his or her attorney. And that was also under 971 5.23. But now what's added to that, and I think this is where there's going to be litigation, and to go back to the caller's question, it says to refuse an interview, deposition, or other discovery request made by the accused. Now, this language, I think, was language that was taken from other areas around the country where this was passed, and I don't think that this language was specifically tailored to Wisconsin. So I think there is going to have to be some clarification and some review of that language to give us more specific guidance. But, again, the controlling it's going to be controlling by our ethics and also the federal constitution.
We talked a little bit earlier about delays, and Teresa, the law gives victims the right to timely disposition of the case without unreasonable delay. And we can talk about what, you know, what that means later. But, you know, we've also talked before about the backlog in our local court system. In fact, you both were guests on this show a year ago discussing this very thing. So how can prosecutors ensure the case is tried in a timely manner with a backlog that already exists?
Right, and that is our challenge. And as the judge just said, you know, we, by being diligent and following through on implementing the constitutional amendment, it has caused more court hearings, actually. So time in front of the court is being used, and I understand why, and I think that there's an importance to that. But what's happening then is that's taking away resources that we need in our court system and for trying cases. But COVID-19 is also taking away those resources as far as getting jury trials moving. So what I can tell you is unreasonable is a term that is dependent upon, I think, the circumstances. So we're being very diligent about making a record. What's going on in the case? Is it for lack of diligence, or is it that it just we can't move forward for very legitimate reasons that actually are in the victim's interests because we need to look into something further, or we need to develop some records or gain a witness for the trial day coming up? So we're making a very good record of what is occurring, and I think that's very important, and the victim would have input at that hearing about any delay. And then as we're prioritizing trials, I can tell you the courts have been very cognizant of prioritizing trials with victims and taking that into consideration, and they have been wonderful about trying to make sure that we are following this constitutional amendment as best we can in Marathon County.
From Marathon County, District Attorney Teresa Whetstone and Circuit Judge Mike Moran are guests today on Route 51 as we talk about Marcy's Law, an amendment to the state constitution that aims to give additional rights to crime victims in Wisconsin. When we return, we'll discuss the future of Marcy's Law and hear our guests' thoughts on potential legal challenges that might lie ahead. You can join the conversation, too, by calling 800-780-9742. You can email questions and comments to route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Judge Mike Moran and District Attorney Teresa Whetstone are here today as we discuss the implications and consequences of Marcy's Law in courtrooms across the region. We'll take your questions, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. When calling, please ensure enough time for our producer to answer your call. You can email us, too, route51@wpr.org. We do have a question that came from email. Matt in Wausau is saying that I found the wording of Marcy's Law, the question on the ballot, to be extremely leading. Do you know who wrote that question, Judge?
I don't know who wrote the question. I have no idea. I don't know how that came about. I don't know how much people really understood exactly about the law, but there was, I mean, everybody saw the commercials that were on TV. I couldn't tell you how it was written or whether that was misleading or not misleading or not. Maybe Teresa has some insight on that.
You know, I don't actually know who wrote it either. I know I did receive a number of questions and about it. And, you know, what I would agree with is that there was a lot of interpretation going on about what the language actually meant, and then when you read the ballot, It caused maybe some further confusion. And like I said, I don't know who drafted it, but I can see why someone would felt that way.
Well, I can see it. I mean, I had several people ask me, well, why would somebody, you know, vote against victims? I mean, that's really what the
sure.
question to me was. Well, you know, what do you say? This is the way it was written, and this is the way it was. You know, sometimes these ballots, they don't. People aren't educated enough, or people don't take the time to look at what it's all about. A lot of people that I know, and maybe just because they're friends of mine who are interested in this area, did a lot of research into what. And there was a lot of stuff on social media talking about it. But whether the person who doesn't really spend a whole lot of time reading this stuff or is not, whether they completely understood it, I couldn't really tell you. I couldn't really tell you, but I don't know how it was written. But that's the feedback that I got from people that I knew.
Well, I can tell you, I mean, in Montana, they passed the amendment there, but then it was overturned in 2017 because of a similar issue. It was an issue with the way the question was posed to voters. Critics here also saying the ballot question was posed in that way. And a court challenge ahead of the election called the question misleading as well. I mean, do you see the potential for this to be overturned? I mean, is this going to be challenged in court, Judge? What are your thoughts?
I haven't heard whether it's going to be challenged in court. I don't know. I haven't heard anything about that, to be honest with you. It's a state constitutional issue, so I imagine it would go to our state constitution. It may not be a federal question because it does. I don't know if it's a state constitutional question. I haven't really done the research on it to really know whether there's going to be a challenge or whether there'd be a good challenge to it or not. There may be, I know what's going to happen. There's going to be litigation. As in every new law that comes down, every new charge, every new crime, there's a body of law that develops. People are going to challenge the constitutionality of some of the parts of Marcy's law. Courts are going to rule on it. It's going to go to the Court of Appeals and maybe possibly the Supreme Court. And that gives us all direction on how it's applied. As a judge, we look at case law. My personal view is that a lot of what's in Marcy's law codifies a lot of what was already going on. I think that, and I'm looking at something that talks about one of the most, you know, the part about refusing interview, deposition, or other discovery request. The commentary is the constitutional amendment does not change the prosecutor's duty to disclose evidence relevant to the defendant's innocence, guilt, or punishment, and the things that are still under the state's control. They control the things that are under the victim's control would be under their control. I'm not sure that this is as dramatic of a change as people are thinking that it is, because Wisconsin, you know, had a strong victim advocacy statute in place. But again, I can't make those predictions because, everything is case by case. Every situation is case by case. And a judge has to look at every case, every situation case by case and apply the applicable law. And I certainly know my colleagues are going to do that. But we're still waiting to see that situation because we really haven't seen a lot of the practicality of it except for the scheduling and the, that type of thing up to this point.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that the changes are not this, immense overhaul. The Wisconsin Justice Initiative opposed the law, and their take is that it amounts to a wholesale alteration of our state's criminal justice system. So mm-hmm. That's interesting that it might not have such a big impact here. Teresa, what's your take?
I want to address that too. I just want to be very careful about applying what's happening in other states to what might happen here in Wisconsin. I think other states did modify the law somewhat to meet their state's needs or wants, and I don't know how their voter question was written. And I think every state is going to be different, and mm-hmm. So we can't necessarily say what's happening in those states is going to happen here in Wisconsin because I don't know exactly how it was worded and what they had already in place before it was put on the ballot. But to get back to your question, I think what this law has done has really brought victims' rights to the forefront at every stage of the process. So one thing that really has changed is these rights are effective at the point of victimization. So there's a conscious effort now for law enforcement and our office to notify victims of the bond hearing, for example. When is that person going to first come to court and have their bond set and conditions of bond? That's a change. that court hearings aren't and scheduling isn't taking place in victim crimes outside the courtroom. That's a very big change. That there is input in scheduling, that's a very big change. So to the extent that at every stage now in the process of a victim crime, victims are taken into consideration, you're right, that is a change. But we in Marathon County at least had incorporated so much of that into our system already. I don't feel like there are time and resources that need to be invested in making sure this is done right, but the foundation was already there. So it doesn't feel as drastic of a change. My concern, as the judge has just expressed, that when we are fully up and running and operational again, I am concerned about, you know, the victim witness resources, the court time, that we're going to be able to sustain this without delays.
Do you think trials will be lengthier because of the law?
I don't think trials will be lengthier. I think that proceedings leading up to trial will be lengthier. I think that because we're taking a lot of things that we were able to do off the record and the court could be functioning on the record, we're bringing those now all into the courtroom. And I don't know how the judge feels about that, but I feel like that is a pretty significant change in the how court time is allotted, and I think court time is very precious in Marathon County, and I think that it's a wonderful thing, but it's also not taking into consideration the fact that we need more resources to be able to do this right.
We are, we are getting a sixth branch in Marathon County, which is going to help, and that's going to start next year. Resource time is important. I agree 100% with what Teresa's saying. The biggest changes here I see are the amount of time we're going to be in court, doing things that we weren't previously in court doing, scheduling, having the ability to input, doing all those types of things, and initial appearances, asking. We work right now with the new law that we assume on victim cases or cases that there's a victim named in the complaint that they're going to want to appear and opt in. We just make that assumption. And that's going to take time, and under the law, that's an important part of that's important. That's the consideration. As far as the other considerations that I know that the defense bar and the prosecution are going to be concerned about, we're going to follow the constitutions. We're going to follow the federal constitutions, and I don't think it has as dramatic of effect, or it will have that effect that a lot of people are thinking, because we still have case law, we still have the constitutional protections. We just have now a constitutional protection under Marcy's law for victims or people named as victims in complaints. And it's an added consideration that we're going to have to work through case law and work through. But it hasn't changed the United States Constitution. It hasn't changed the Wisconsin Constitution. Those rights of due process are still there for everyone. It just means that it's expanded it.
Just to give you some idea, there's about 1,500 or so cases active in the system. That's not counting post-conviction cases, hearings that might be occurring, sentencing after revocation and probation, things like that. So that's the amount of cases, not the amount of victims, number of victims. But that gives you an idea. It's a pretty significant volume.
If you think about it, we are allowing the potential for victim input in post-conviction when probation and parole does restitution orders after the conviction. There's a lot of post-conviction, there's a lot of different types of hearings before that victims were not a part of or were not noticed that they could be to opt in. Those are a lot of extra hearings that we're scheduling, and that's where it comes in, that it's all about time. We're working through it. I mean, we're working our schedules through it, and we'll work through it. It's just going to be an adjustment period, and once we get back to after the virus and after the COVID, and we open up to a full, we're gonna experiment, and it's going to be a slow process, but we're gonna make it through it.
I'm glad you brought up restitution. I know that victims now have the right to full restitution from any person who's been ordered to pay restitution to the victim and to be provided with assistance collecting that restitution. So how is that different from before, Teresa? And
Yeah,
and who's providing that
really
assistance?
Interesting.
That's a good question.
That is a question on the forefront of our office's mind. We are looking at, we've constantly actually been looking at that. You know, it's difficult because in a process where, let's say, restitution is ordered and an individual does not succeed on probation, it's a misdemeanor crime, and jail is really the only option, what happens to that restitution is it's converted to a civil judgment, and the collection of that restitution then through the civil judgment process really falls on the victim. So we are looking at that, and what does the word assistance really mean? It's not really defined, but, you know, there's nothing stopping individual counties from really looking at the intent of this law and doing everything we can to fix them within the power of our county. We are looking at that right now, actually. So
that's an interesting question, that's for sure. We've talked a lot about the rights of victims in this past hour, and I know one thing I wanted to bring up, that victims now have the right to be notified if an alleged perpetrator is released on bond. That wasn't happening before, Teresa?
It was. You know, with the difficulty is knowing how to notify a victim if they haven't been in contact with our office. There has been a process in place in Marathon County for a long time where you can register with the jail and be notified if the person posts their bond. So I don't know how much of a change in process that's actually going to be. I mean, we have tried very hard to do that already if the person is seeking to have that. So it's a coordination of systems to make sure that that there is a automatic trigger that is put in place when someone does post.
And victims are also granted reasonable protection from the accused through the criminal and juvenile justice process. Teresa, what does that mean exactly?
Well, I think that's
your last
question. You're asking tough questions.
I think that's a codification, again, of everything that was sort of in place. So let's think about what we just talked about, not being required to do a deposition or meet with a investigator that's hired by the defense, or even things like, you know, they shouldn't have to sit in the hallway with the defendant waiting for a court hearing. There should be accommodations made where that person has very limited, if at all, contact with the offender or supporters of the offender who may have conflict with that person. And so the protections are, just as emphasizing what has been, at least in Marathon County, a focus already, and making sure that it all goes back to what this law is all about, which is treating victims at every stage of this process with fairness, dignity, and respect. And if you're doing that, or, you know, we're doing it to the best of our ability, it is that, you know, that should be honored already, protecting the victim from the offender, whether it be a physical barrier or by being in a different room or not being harassed or not violating no contact provisions and so on and so forth. So that protection, I think, is an important one. And, you know, this process is very tough for victims. It is a lengthy process often. It's full of delays and frustrations, and we definitely want to have that protection for victims, and they feel like they can count on that.
I have one final question for each of you, and I'd really love to get your input on this. Obviously, our justice system is not perfect. There's no justice system in the world that is perfect. But if you could reshape the system, if you could have one thing that would be different, what would you like to see happen? Teresa, one thing that you think that would be just a phenomenal change to our system?
The sufficient amount of resources to ensure justice for all. I think that, you know, defendants have due process rights. Victims have the right to have their case evaluated properly by a prosecutor from all angles and to spend time with that prosecutor to understand the system, or victim witness personnel to have the case move through the system and have the judicial resources and the defense attorney resources and the prosecutor resources and law enforcement resources to do this right. It is so important for everyone involved. These are people's lives. And if I had one wish, it would be that we were properly resourced.
Well, that is all we have time for today on Route 51. Judge, I have to leave it there. I'm so sorry. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guests, Judge Mike Moran, District Attorney Teresa Whetstone. So appreciate you being here today. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route51. Next week, we'll talk about sustainable living solutions with guests from what would have been the annual Energy Fair, which is now canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Until then, we're heading out of town.